The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Between the Synapse with Mark Tobin. If you're looking to learn something useful, you've come to the wrong place. But as Belushi once said, it don't cost nothing. So let's get things started. Here's Mark Tobin.
All right, and welcome to Between the Synapse. As the lady said, I'm your host, Mark Tobin, and thanks for listening live or perhaps later on the podcast. Speaking of podcasts, you can check out all previous 61 of them on my blog at BetweenTheSynapse.com. Right there on the right side of the page, just click, and to your heart's content, you can binge one after another. You can listen to all the shows. You can also sign up to receive notices of future shows also on the right side of the page. Just leave your name and email, and you'll get notices of all future shows as well. Also, check me out on Twitter at Between T Synapse. And if you're so moved, to send an email with good, bad, or indifferent content, shoot it over at mbt@betweenthesynapse.com. And, of course, you can find me on Facebook at Between the Synapse. So today's show, the state of oil. Little double entendre coming from Texas. We're going to be trying to get our hands around this subject that that drive us crazy every day. No pun intended, or perhaps so. We're talking to Douglas Fauchet, who is the former chairman and CEO and president of El Paso Corporation, which runs the largest gas pipeline in North America, as well as one of the largest producers of gas in North America as well. And he's going to help us understand where we are both in the world as well as in the state of Texas, so that when you go to the pump, you have a little firmer understanding of just what is happening now. There have been a lot of changes in the dynamics in this field. Doug, welcome to the show. All right, so you know, the last year has been pretty crazy at the pump. You know, prices were up near $3, and then all of a sudden people were looking, hey, it's whatever, $220, $230. It was kind of crazy. Now things are around $250, $260. So jobs have been lost now because it doesn't look like the production is going to be as high. Just in a snapshot, where are we right now in terms of the oil business?
It's a pretty interesting time. beginning probably over a decade ago, we as an industry began to use technologies related to horizontal drilling and fracture stimulation that over time really changed not just the energy business in the U.S., but around the world. And in essence, what's happened for most of the last decade is as U.S. oil production has grown, it has displaced oil from the rest of the world needing to be imported into the U.S. And eventually what happened in that environment is that classic supply exceeding demand, and you saw in the last year, a dramatic drop in the commodity price. So the sort of $64 question is the recovery in oil prices a U, meaning down and a flat spot and back up? Is it a V? Is it a W? Is this oil bubble a bubble, or is it actually going to turn into a sausage? And so we're sort of in the middle of that right now. If you look back over time, I think I've been involved in every commodity cycle since about 1982. And kind of the range of recovery is from, you know, 3 or 4 months to in 1985, that peak to trough to peak was almost 5 years.
And now, yeah, we're looking at, you know, it seems like 5 days sometimes.
Yeah, well, you know, it's difficult for me. In fact, I don't have enough knowledge to explain to you the daily fluctuations at the gas pump, but the big swings in crude oil prices, you know, we had a 50% drop in the price of the commodity in a matter of months. It now recovered to some extent. The industry is benefited by the fact that, you know, interest rates are very, very low. Capital markets remain open. And so as soon as we saw a little bit of recovery in oil prices from, you know, in the 50s to north of 60, what you saw was the energy industry, the public company portion of the energy industry, went out and raised significant amounts of debt and equity capital and sort of recapitalized themselves to withstand this low oil price environment. And even recently, you've seen people starting to put drilling rigs back to work, and, you know, our rig count dropped by 50% along with the commodity price. So that, I think, has people somewhat concerned that, of course, that means that the fall off in supply won't be quite as fast, and therefore prices stay down longer. And if you're a Houstonian, you know that the Houston economy in particular is pretty significantly impacted by the health of the energy business.
Yeah, I just heard a report published, I can't remember who did it, but I think it was in Forbes or something, that said that Houston has I think they called it the greatest fluctuation in jobs, and that is because of the concentration of energy firms here and their reliance on contract workers. I guess that's something that started probably beginning in, you know, coming out of the 80s, and they didn't want to have to commit to full-time workers, and so they started relying on contractors who they could add or lay off given the needs.
Yeah, I think, you know, any industry that's predominantly a field-oriented industry has, by and large, a larger number of contractors in the field. It's interesting, you know, if you go back to the mid-80s, when that was sort of the worst economic downturn in Houston, probably in history, certainly in recent history, and you compare that to today, we haven't seen nearly the reaction, the negative reaction in the Houston economy that we saw back then. You might be able to argue, well, that's just because we're early in the cycle. But I think there's more to it than that, because remember that for all of the bad things that happen when oil and natural gas prices are down related to the Houston economy, and that's the so-called upstream industry, the flip side is that the downstream industries are doing quite well. So you see the east side of Houston, the petrochemical complex, is expanding significantly, and that creates a lot of jobs, and that's sort of muted the impact, along with, you know, we've got a significant port facility and a significant healthcare industry in the Texas Medical Center, that each of which has grown since the mid-80s. So at the margin, we're probably less reliant on energy, but still the biggest center of energy employment in the world.
And for those listening, you know, outside of Houston, and once again, I want to thank all Between the Synapse listeners outside of Texas, and there are quite a bit, including all around the world, who aren't familiar with Houston and our port. Houston has it's one of the top three, four ports in the country, world. What's the deal on
that? Yeah, I'm no port expert, but yes, it's in the top three in the U.S. and among the top ports in the world, and the Texas Medical Center is the largest medical center in the world by a factor of three, I think was the last. If the Texas Medical Center were a downtown, it would be the 19th largest downtown in America.
Well, that explains the traffic.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, no, it actually is incredible what goes on there. And the port itself is something that, you know, was dredged. It's been dredged, I don't know, at least twice. And I think there may be more plans in order to make it deeper. But what that allows are for a number of petrochemical plants to be operated up and along that. And therefore, it allows for a lot of exports in particular to be manufactured in this area and then sent around the world.
Yes. Not just petrochemical products, of course, because a big component of the port is it's sort of the gateway to Central and Latin America.
Right, right, yeah, and then you know, of course, a lot of things come in here as well. So, in terms of sort of understanding, you know, the cycle. I mean, It just seems that things that used to drive prices with greater immediacy don't quite do that anymore. In particular, you know, the Middle East. I mean, there is obviously every day in the Middle East there's turmoil, but there's a great deal of turmoil right now with what's going on in Syria and with ISIS and all the threats to a number of oil fields and the fact that ISIS even controls a number of oil fields. Yet that doesn't seem to have the direct impact on prices that it did, you know, even, you know, 5 years ago.
Right. Well, I think part of the reason for that, of course, remember that a big part of the reason that the primary reason that oil prices plummeted 6 months ago was Saudi Arabia's decision to take back market share that it had lost over the last decade, and it lost a significant portion of that market share to U.S.-based shale oil production. So once Saudi Arabia decided to unconstrain its production, you saw the dramatic price drop. But if you look, I'm just looking at June OPEC supply, which was 32 million barrels a day into the world economy. The Saudi Arabia was 10.5 million barrels a day. So Saudi Arabia in the month of June was up year over year 150,000 barrels a day. And Iraq was up, produced 4.4 million barrels a day, was up almost over half a million barrels a day month to month. And so what hasn't happened, in spite of all the turmoil, what hasn't happened is there hasn't been a large Middle East supply disruption. And so I think people have gotten maybe at the margin more comfortable with Middle East political issues and Middle East supply issues being separate. And in addition to that, the fact that the U.S., now produces roughly 10 million barrels a day of crude oil domestically is another sort of insulating factor because it's considered a secure supply source.
And we got to take a break. When we get back, I want to ask you a little bit more about OPEC and how it's changed, because it certainly is not the singular force that it used to be, but we've got to take a couple minutes and we'll be right back with Doug Fauché on Between the Synapse. Stick around.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
There are over 140 million products manufactured worldwide.
It is impossible to know the ingredients in these products, especially those made overseas. Stan Salat, creator of the HSF Mark and the Counterfeit Mark Alliance, is the host of People to People, working together for your safety. Stan believes in our right to know the type and amount of hazardous materials in consumer products and whether they are counterfeit. Find out how you can protect yourself every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety. Tune into the Voice America Variety channel on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Voice America Variety broadcasts a diverse array of topics reaching a global community. Our experts come from all walks of life, and the topics they discuss are everything from current events, arts and entertainment, leadership, parenting, relationships, self-improvement, career advice, and a variety of other topics. Check us out today. You're sure to find something of interest. Voice America Variety. Talk on today's hot topics.
What can you find on Get Real Radio? Well, quite honestly, who you really are. Join host James Robinson each week for a program designed to reveal more about yourself and your world through words of wisdom and profound guests. You'll discover more about the spiritual movement and how it can work with you and alert you to problems you may not be aware of. It will educate, titillate, and enlighten your mind. Get Real Radio is broadcast live every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. This could end up being the best time of your week.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mvt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
And we're back on Between the Synapse, and we are talking to Douglas Fauché, who's the former president, CEO, and chairman of the board of El Paso Corp. He has spent his career in the oil and gas energy and currently sits on the boards of Cameron International, as well as Rice University and Houston Endowment, Inc. Before we get back to OPEC, I wanted to ask you if you could explain what exactly happened in the United States, because we certainly had lost our, I wouldn't say our ability, but certainly were not competing in terms of volume with the Middle East and certain other producers. And so we were having to import quite a bit of oil, and strategically and politically, that was dramatically affecting how we had to act diplomatically. But things changed, and could you take us through that process?
Yeah, well, at a very basic level, you know, so and this is how sort of the first 25 years of my career in this industry existed. If you could think of a coffee, an upside down coffee cup lying 12,000 feet below the surface of the earth, and that upside-down coffee cup was full of crude oil, natural gas, and water, that's sort of what we spent our careers searching for. So we use geology, we use geophysics to try to determine where we should drill to find that sort of underground, upside-down coffee cup that held these hydrocarbons. Well, in effect, what in geologic time, what happened is well below that coffee cup, there was a base, which we sort of called the kitchen, which was shale, where the hydrocarbons were actually formed. And then in geologic time, they migrated up into that upside down coffee cup where they were trapped. That's sort of the business forever. So we always knew that down below that coffee cup, there was this base of hydrocarbons, but it looked like if you could imagine a sheet of marble, It had no porosity, it had no permeability, and therefore was considered to be not producible. Two things happened that changed that calculation dramatically. One was horizontal drilling. So we gained the ability to, for example, drill down 12, 15,000 feet and then drill out, in some cases, 8,000 feet. And what that allowed you to do is let's say that that shale formation was 50 feet thick. You could, by drilling into it and then paralleling, you could expose the wellbore to a lot greater amount of hydrocarbons, but still you couldn't produce them until we perfected fracture stimulation, which in essence you pump pressure down into the wellbore that cracks
the formation.
And
pressure is typically, is that air that or water or both?
It's fluid. Yeah,
fluid.
It's fluid and sand. And so what happens is when you once you put enough pressure in it and the rock cracks and the fluid goes into those cracks along with the sand, then when you take the pressure off, those cracks collapse, but they can't collapse all the way because the sand is in there. And that creates the porous, permeable pathway for the hydrocarbons to then get to the wellbore and be produced. And the impact of that is we went from, domestically, from a country that was perennially in decline, both in terms of crude oil and natural gas, to a country that in the last decade has added 4 or 5 million barrels a day of new production to the U.S. system. And you're right, it sort of has changed the strategic balance in the world to some degree.
Well, I assume that is more expensive than the traditional kinds of drilling. It certainly is less expensive than offshore.
Well, it's a different animal than offshore, but it is the best of the crude oil shale plays can generate adequate returns at crude oil prices below the average offshore production. That is true.
All right, and I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I mean, that has been the biggest single change in my career. And so if you could think then about how that might change how the industry operates, we went from drilling wells where, in essence, each well was its own entity. In other words, every one of those upside-down coffee cups I talked about, they were unique. They had their own special characteristics. Now think about, as opposed to an upside-down coffee cup, think about a tabletop. And that tabletop is, hundreds of thousands of acres across. And it's not exactly the same, but it has a lot of homogeneity. And so now, instead of trying to find the coffee cup, you're in essence trying to manufacture hydrocarbons. So think of an Intel chip manufacturing facility, but outdoors. So the whole idea of production changes. Now you want to drill every well almost exactly like the well before it, except you want to make marginal improvements. So you start focusing on continuous improvement and supply chain logistics and all those kinds of things. It's like turning the industry on its head.
So guessing game is dramatically eliminated, is what you're saying.
Well, it changes. You don't have to guess where the hydrocarbons are. So now the art becomes making sure that you can effectively extract those hydrocarbons, which is an engineering and operations challenge.
And that's where it becomes controversial, right? Because there are issues with water contamination that people are concerned about. There are issues with the cavities that are created and concerns about earthquakes in areas that have never experienced earthquakes and other kinds of environmental concerns that have been created either by the underground kinds of techniques that are being done or by what's being done above ground. And you know, I guess, number one, it becomes, you know, A, is it worth it? But you know, can you address how the industry is dealing with that? And also, is it just dependent upon who's doing it?
Yeah, I think so. So there are very legitimate environmental questions to be asked about the extraction of hydrocarbons. By the way, just like there are very legitimate questions to be asked environmentally about the production of any energy source. So, you know, if you have a wind farm, you're asking yourself, what is the true cost of decimating migratory bird patterns? And if you're a thermal solar company, you have a different set of environmental concerns. And you know, what's the cost of the footprint of a utility scale solar farm taking up, you know, hundreds or thousands of acres to produce a relatively small amount of energy? And I only bring that up to say there is no zero cost energy source. If you're a nuclear power proponent, you're asking yourself how to safely dispose of nuclear waste. So in the oil and gas business, the issues around shale gas production revolve around water quality, water use, air quality, and then to a lesser extent, the issue of earthquakes in some areas. So, you know, the issue of water quality is absolutely a solvable issue. It's an engineering exercise. There's at least one oil field service supplier that came up with a frac fluid and that you can drink. And so, to me, the water quality issue is eminently solvable and has been solved by energy. Then there's does the drilling operation itself, does a frac contaminate existing water tables? That science is pretty settled. There's no chance, actually, that a fracture-stimulated well at 12,000 feet, that the fracture has any potential to contaminate a water supply, which is typically at 400 or 500 feet. The issue is that well has to drill through the water supply to get down there, and there have been instances where the well bore itself didn't properly seal. That's also an engineering problem, and the best operators don't have that as an issue. To me, water use is a significant issue because it is a fact that in order to fracture stimulate these wells takes significant amounts of water. So, you know, what do you do with the water once you've used it and float it back? How much water is the right amount of water to be able to use in particular areas that may have water shortages? When that produced water is flowed back, does it contain contaminants that can be dealt with or not? Those are all issues but I view those as engineering problems that can be solved, not insurmountable environmental issues. They all have costs associated with them.
Right. And I hate to assume, but I assume that earlier on these were much more issues than they are now and will be in the future. And I'm not trying to put under the carpet the fact that these are legitimate issues.
Yeah, I think it's an ongoing dialogue. If you say early on, of course, no one knew that any of this was an issue. So then there was a period of time when people said, wait, you know, these things are happening. They're affecting my home. They're affecting my neighborhood. And so then you go through this process of research to find out what's real and what's imagined and what root cause analysis is for all of these things. And then the industry starts to deal with it and the public deals with it and regulations are put in place. So I think all of that is going on, but the debate doesn't end. I mean, there are those who absolutely want an end to crude oil and natural gas production because they want an end to hydrocarbon production, and so for that reason, the debate will go on.
Right. All right, and that's I want to tie that into the OPEC discussion. We got to take another break, so stick around on Between the Synapse.
Stimulating talk.
Gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
How do you achieve the utmost success in your life, career, faith, relationships, and more? It's all here in The Business of Living with host Scott Ventrella. Scott has experience as an executive coach, sought-after speaker, and lecturer. He and his guests will offer practical solutions and strategies to help you move to the next level of success, no matter where you are in your life and career. The Business of Living airs live every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
American Heroes Network is a program for and about our American veteran heroes and their families. Join host Gary Ray as he shows what is being done to help our veterans and showcase the companies and organizations that are helping our veterans and their families rebuild their lives. Listen for American Heroes Network, live and powered by the Voice America Variety Channel, every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mbt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
All right. We are back on Between the Synapse, talking about the oil business with Douglas Fauché, who's the former chairman, president, and CEO of El Paso Corporation, where he oversaw North America's largest natural gas pipeline system and one of North America's largest natural gas producers. We've been talking about what's happened in the last 10 years in the domestic energy production in terms of fracking and its impact on the international energy markets. Which has led the United States to be, Doug. So where does the United States fit now in terms of producer of oil and gas in the world?
Well, let's see. Last month, I think Saudi Arabia, if I remember my math correctly, produced roughly. Hold on, I've got it right here. Saudi Arabia produced 10.5 million barrels a day in the month of June. I think the U.S. produced, you know, something like 9.7 million barrels a day.
So we're number two.
The U.S. has been for the last several years in the top two or three producers in the world with Saudi and Russia.
Which, you know, is a big change, and it changes a lot besides, you know, things that affect our economy and changes how we interact diplomatically. We talked about OPEC earlier and you know, from the time of the 70s really until just the last handful of years, OPEC operated as a very, very tight unit. appears to be no longer the case. And I don't know how familiar you are specifically with how OPEC runs, but now it just seems to be Saudi Arabia kind of pulling away, calling their own shots, and not so much working with the other OPEC nations, which, by the way, also includes countries like Venezuela and countries around the world.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, one of the things that's changed is that every president since Nixon, I think, has talked about the U.S. becoming energy independent. And, you know, of course, every president since then has been saying that while domestic production has been on sort of a steady decline. I think now, for the first time, people disagree with me on this. I don't think that the U.S. will be energy independent, but you can say that North America could be energy independent within our lifetimes, and that changes everything because that's certainly not the case for some of our rivals in the world, most specifically China. And so the change in OPEC has been really that while the U.S., which is is sort of the biggest demand center for crude oil, biggest consumer, was on decline, then all of that extra demand was being filled by OPEC, and prices were going up. And so now we find ourselves in a position where a decade ago, I don't know what the number was exactly, but Saudi Arabia by itself had significant spare capacity. So they were producing a constrained amount. Now, at their current, 10 million barrels a day, their excess capacity is significantly lower, which just means that they have less of an ability to continue to impact oil prices by themselves. And I think the same holds true for OPEC generally. There's very little spare capacity in OPEC, and that means there's not much ability for them to do anything other than, what they're doing, which is producing close to everything they can.
Right, but don't they, and didn't they kind of indicate this when they increased production, 6 months ago, have the ability at least to move prices downward to where it makes it very difficult for the United States to produce oil? Because as we talked about earlier, there is a cost of the fracking process, which makes it uneconomical, right? And Saudi Arabia is still doing it traditionally. They just have to basically, stick a needle in the sand at a certain level and oil comes up, and it's the cheapest way that you can explore for oil. And so we still have to do it at a more expensive means. And at a certain point, if oil falls, it's not economical for us to do it.
Right. So here is everything you said has some truth, has a significant amount of truth to it. But remember, one, that when you're counting the cost in Saudi, you have to count the social costs. And so when you add the social costs of Saudi into that equation, the price that they actually need for crude oil in order to pay all those social costs is actually quite high, and even higher.
When you say social costs, you mean what exactly?
I mean the subsidizing everything else in those countries, and it's actually higher than that if you think about Iran. And so, meaning it takes, because that's their only source of income, it takes a relatively high price of crude oil to be able to fund the cost of those governments. So
diversification isn't something that really is set in yet.
What's that?
Diversification of economy is not something that has set in yet over the last 40 years.
No, and also remember that the demand for crude oil globally goes up a percent to a percent and a half a year. And so if you think about the fact that all of those countries are, most of those countries are producing much closer to their capacity already, and then you think about demand continuing to grow, and you think about U.S. supply at some point in this environment going on decline, that's how you get a price response that's positive. The second thing is, remember that in the U.S., our industry is getting more efficient every day. So the best parts of the oil shale plays today actually generate returns at oil prices substantially below the current oil price.
And do you have an estimate in terms of what percentage that's changed over the time since it started? Is it 30% more efficient, 40%?
Oh, well, the efficiency, well, I'll give you a kind of a real world example. When the Haynesville Shale, which is in East Texas, Louisiana area, which is a natural gas play, not an oil play, but at El Paso, I think the first well that we drilled in the Haynesville Shale, to drill and complete that well took 57 days. And of course, think about most of the things involved in drilling an oil and gas well are a day rate, so days equal dollars. So 57 days to drill the first well. The last well we drilled before our merger with Kinder Morgan, which is the last data point I have, was 19 days.
If I had some paper, I would do the math.
Yeah, so you know, well over a 50% drop in the number of days. And that kind of continuous improvement goes on year after year after year. So, you know, the best, the top quartile producers are getting 10-15% efficiency gains every year. And, of course, remember that when this oil price collapse happened 6 months ago, the first thing that happened is the cost of service, oil field services, dropped significantly. So if you were, prior to this, if your well was economic at $70 a barrel, just lower service costs might mean that it's now economic at $55 or $60 a barrel.
Interesting. And all right, I know you've got to go after this next break, which we're getting close to, but I want to ask you one last question. It's I guess maybe a little bit on the esoteric side. We've been talking in this country about alternative energies, and you brought them up as well. And we've been, you know, talking about this for the last three decades, the last probably two decades in earnest, and whether it be solar or wind or nuclear or whatever that be, and even hydrogen and all certain forms of different kinds of ways to run our cars and automobiles. We know that at some point, you know, we will run out of oil and gas, whether that's 50 years, 150 years, whatever that number is. I'm sure it's beyond our lifetimes. This is, you know, certainly my position is the new processes that have been developed in this country have essentially given us an opportunity to work on these alternative fuels in a way that is under less pressure than we would have been, you know, even 10 years ago, because of the fact that we now have some parity in oil and gas, and we're not so dependent upon Saudi Arabia's and the others in the world as we've just talked about. Yeah. Yet there certainly is a lot of animosity, I think, between a lot of the industries, between the alternative and the traditional oil and gas companies. How do you see it playing out? What do you see is sort of the optimal process in order to have these two forms coexist as we go forward?
Right. Well, I think, you know, the debate really is about cost. So if you're an alternative, if you're an oil and gas producer, you would say, look, we're for any alternative form of energy as long as it competes. And boy, you know, wind energy doesn't compete, so it has to be subsidized. Solar energy doesn't compete; it has to be subsidized. And we put tens of billions of dollars into solar energy, and it's 0.5% of utility scale electric production today. Now that would be the traditional argument on one side. The other side of the argument, of course, is, well, wait a minute. There's a social cost to the production of hydrocarbons in terms of its impact on the economy. And if you added a realistic social cost to it, then some of these other alternative forms would be much more cost competitive. And that is the debate. And I think it's going to continue to be the debate. My own view, there's only one way, in my view, that an alternative to fossil fuels will happen, and that is price. Price drives innovation and ingenuity. We saw it. When oil prices were very high a year ago, 2 years ago, and natural gas prices were very low, what did we see? We saw massive shifts in fleet use from diesel-fired trucks to natural gas-fired trucks without government intervention. Why? Because diesel was $5 a gallon and natural gas equivalent to diesel was $1.20 a gallon. So until we get to the point where either fossil fuels are high enough that it allows for innovation so that people can generate alternatives that make a profit without government subsidy, or the other side wins a national debate and we have some form of a carbon tax, you won't see, in my view, significant increases in alternative energy.
All right. Well, that'll have to do it for now. I know you've got to run. I wanted to also ask you about some of your engagements and involvements with education, but I will have to bring you back another time because I know you've been doing some really strong work in helping kids advance on those fronts. But I want to thank you so much for joining Between the Synapse. Doug Fauché, thanks for joining Between the Synapse. We'll be right back on Between the Synapse.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
Are you or someone you know interested in attending college? With both college tuition and college enrollment up 60% since 2002, there is a lot of competition, and careful planning needs to be a part of the process. Tune in to Getting In, a College Coach Conversation, hosted by Elizabeth Heaton and featuring a team of college coach experts. We'll bring you the tips, techniques, and know-how to navigate the road to college and do so the smart way. Listen live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
All around the outermost rim of the shield, he set the mighty stream of the river Oceanus, creating Achilles' shield in Homer's The Iliad, Book 18.
Rachel Carson in The Sea Around Us said, "All at last, return to the sea, to Oceanus, the ocean river, like the ever-flowing stream of time, the beginning and the end."
Moyer's Environmental Dialogues with Dr. Rob Moyer offers lively dialogue and revealing narrative inquiry into how individuals are overcoming obstacles and creating a greener and blue planet Earth.
Tune in Thursdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mvt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
All right. We're back on Between the Synapse. I'm Mark Tobin. I want to once again thank my guest, Doug Fauché, for joining us. Very interesting stuff on the oil and gas business. Sometimes people get very focused on one perspective on that. And, you know, it's either all environmental or it's all business. And there are many aspects of the energy business. And anybody who just takes one perspective, you just can't do it. Because this isn't something that we can live without, and it would be, you know, so easy to dismiss one side or the other and say, oh, we've got to have, everything's got to be green, or, you know, we can't, this is too important, we can't give any consideration to environmental concerns. They're both have to be considered. And I thought Doug did a very nice job of explaining that and giving us some inside viewpoints in terms of how that happens from somebody who served in the highest levels in the energy business. Living in Houston, the energy capital of the world, certainly. You develop a certain perspective, nobody wants to see an environment which is made worse in order for our energy levels to be on par with the rest of the country. And I think it's important to know that it isn't necessarily a zero-sum game. But it is important, however, that we are, you know, no longer as dependent upon the import of foreign oil as we were, you know, 5-10 years ago. That is significant. And I also think it's significant that, as Doug said, that the industry is getting better. And I also think it's important that we as citizens, as consumers, continue to hold accountable the industry so that they continue to strive to get better. And particularly people in individual states need to do the same. Because if that doesn't happen, I think that there's the potential for certain people within the industry to slack off. And so it is up to everyone in order to make sure that this happens in a way that is beneficial for the entire country and that doesn't challenge our environment any more than is necessary. So I want to thank Doug again. As I said, we didn't get to talk to Doug about some of his other issues. He's highly involved in education, has a tremendous resume. He's on the boards of Rice University and Kipp Academy and Houston Endowment. He also previously chaired the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, the Houston branch, and actually received in 2007 the Ellis Island Medal of Honor for his commitment to helping children succeed in his leadership role in the business community. So it really was a pleasure having Doug on the show. All right, we've just got another minute. I want to thank everybody for listening. Remind you to check out my blog on BetweenTheSynapse.com. I personally am watching Twitter to find out if, in fact, LaMarcus Aldridge signs with the Spurs. Hopefully that'll happen very soon. Big news in Spurs land. And we'll see. I want to thank my producer, Winston Price. I want to thank Nick behind the scenes engineering the show. I want to thank everyone for listening. Join me next week on Between the Synapse. Take care. Have a happy 4th of July.
Thanks again for joining us this week. Mark Tobin and Between the Synapse will transmit once again next Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. And remember, you never know what lies between the synapse.